I want to share a story with you this morning, and when I'm finished, I will tell you who the author is. There is a book named Mr. Peabody's Apples. In this story, all the good people of Happyville live a fine existence, sort of like life in Andy Griffith's Mayberry. The elementary school teacher, Mr. Peabody, devotes his summertime Saturdays to organizing baseball games for the town's children. Each Saturday, the boys and girls gather and have a wonderful time participating in the nation's pastime. And after each game, once the bats and balls have been collected and the children have walked home, Mr. Peabody walks home too. One Saturday, Tommy Tittlebottom just happens to see Mr. Peabody on his way home, and what he sees surprises him no end. Mr. Peabody stops in front of the local grocery store and picks out an apple from the display bin, drops it in his bag, and continues on his way. Tommy could not believe his eyes. The very next Saturday, after the game, Tommy gathers his friends and they wait across the street from the store to see if this terrible travesty will happen again. It does. Mr. Peabody takes another apple, the biggest one, drops it in his bag, and continues on his way home. Tommy and his friends tell everyone they know about Mr. Peabody. Their word spread like wildfire, and the next Saturday, no one shows up to play ball except for Billy. With tears in his eyes, Billy tells his coach that everyone thinks he's a thief. Mr. Peabody and Billy go back to the store. The owner explains it all to Billy. Mr. Peabody pays for the apples when he buys his groceries and picks one up after each Saturday baseball game. Billy runs to tell Tommy, and Tommy comes to Mr. Peabody to apologize. The final act of the book finds Mr. Peabody inviting Tommy to bring a feather pillow with him to the baseball field. Once they meet, Mr. Peabody cuts open the pillow, and as Tommy holds it high, the feathers fly fast and far in the breeze. The coach then asks the child to collect all the feathers, and the lesson is learned. Words once spoken cannot be gathered again. Now, the author of Mr. Peabody's Apples is none other than the singer Madonna. Tommy looked around him and saw what he thought he saw and spoke to what he thought he understood. But he simply did not know enough of the story. All that needs to be known is not yet known. The same thing can be said for the people who lived in Galatia. They knew Jesus had lived and died. They believed in their hearts that he had risen from the dead and that he was coming back again. But as they looked around them, as they experienced the challenges of their lives, what they saw did not match what they had experienced. And so words that could demean and divide, words that could tear down and weaken their community, began to be spoken. And like the feathers blowing in the breeze, these words were gaining momentum. And like Mr. Peabody, Paul's integrity and credibility were being called into question. In the opening five verses of his letter, Paul succinctly introduced the two main topics of his letter, his apostleship and his gospel. As we see in our passage this morning, Paul now turns his attention to the other main theme of the letter. And the reason he does this is because some questions were being asked as a result of the false teachers. It is clear from Paul's responses that people wanted to know why they had to listen to the Apostle Paul. Where did Paul get this teaching from, and how come his gospel gets to be the one that judges everyone else? In other words, who put you in charge, Paul? In order to explain how he received this direct revelation of Jesus Christ, Paul takes us back to an earlier part of his life. He reminds us here of his former life as a zealous practitioner of the Jewish religion. Paul gives us an indicator here of how seriously he practiced his religion. He says he persecuted the church of God. That is, he persecuted Christians. So there is Paul, so concerned for the truth of his Jewish heritage that he would stop at nothing to defend and protect it. But after Paul's conversion, the zeal with which he had persecuted and tortured Christians was now the zeal with which he labored to produce and preserve them through the preaching of the gospel. Imagine, if you will, a loyal and zealous UNC fan heading off to watch the Tar Heels play NC State, when suddenly, on the way to the game, there is a blinding flash of light, and this fanatic Tar Heel fan suddenly began shouting, "Go State! Go State!" while breathing threats and curses down upon the miserable UNC Tar Heels. It would have to be divine intervention for something like that to happen. And that's Paul's main premise. God is the one that changed Paul's life and heart in such a radical way. Paul then stresses in this passage his independence from the Jerusalem authorities. Even as he acknowledges that he visited them, his words read almost like a defensive explanation, an alibi, a sort of response to the question, "Where were you on the night of the crime?" Paul emphasizes that even though he might have gone to Jerusalem a time or two, the Jerusalem people added nothing to his message. Lest we miss the point, he says it twice. He mentions that after his conversion, he didn't go to Jerusalem, but he went off to Arabia and then Damascus. Then, when he made it to Jerusalem, he stayed with Cephas 2 weeks and saw James, the Lord's brother. What he is saying is that he wasn't around the Jerusalem apostles long enough to be influenced by their message. Paul is walking a very narrow, tight rope at this point. He must maintain that he is a legitimate apostle and explain why he did go to Jerusalem. But he feels he must also declare that these central figures in early Christianity really offered nothing to him. It has been said that it is Paul's quest for independence, personal independence, that led to his striking theological vision, a vision so unique and powerful that it has been the primary shaper of Christian theology to this day. Paul was able to handle seemingly contradictory thoughts and fuse them with tremendous personal energy that resulted in the letters of the New Testament. The later chapters of Galatians will show how he managed to do this. Here in chapter 1, he lays the groundwork for his understanding of the gospel. He was uniquely chosen, and he is independent. He finally mentions that those who heard of his conversion glorified God because of it. Paul's life was a channel of blessing for which other Christians were thankful, most especially because it was the channel through which they came to know about God and were being built up in the faith. Thinking of this can provide us with an occasion to ask ourselves of how can I live my life in such a way that people would glorify God because of how he used me. What changes could I make that if people close to me saw them, it might cause them to respect God? There is power in our words. There is power in our tongues. And there is life and death in what we say and how we say it. Paul knew it. Mr. Peabody knew it. And now you and I know it. Amen.